Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Gelton, and this is On Point. Over the years, many UFO stories, people claim they've seen flying saucers, pilots report strange objects hovering in the air around them. Now we learn the Pentagon has been investigating UFOs in secret. A $22 million program, now defunct, has come to light. What did it turn up? And why are we so interested in who and what might be out there? This hour on Point, UFOs and the search for the truth. You can join us on air or online. Do you believe in UFOs? Do you want the U.S. government investigating them? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter or on Facebook at On Point Radio. So we've heard a lot about UFOs over the years. One of the new things to consider is a video that was released by the Department of Defense. It shows Navy pilots encountering an unknown object in 2004. Here's the sound of the pilots speaking to each other.
There's a whole fleet of them. Look on the ASA. My gosh. They're all going against the wind. The wind's 120 knots to the west. Look at that thing, dude. That's not our LNS, though, is it? It's not.
That is the LNS, dude.
Well, if there's like
a that thing,
it's rotating.
It's rotating. And one of the pilots in that exchange was retired Navy Commander David Fravor. He was the pilot who encountered a 40-foot-long wingless object off the coast of California. Here he was speaking on CNN last night describing why he didn't think it was something from this world.
It had no wings, so you think, okay, it's a helicopter. Well, there's no rotor wash in the water. There's no rotors. And when helicopters move side to side, they kind of slow, and then they pick up speed going the other way. This was extremely abrupt, like a ping pong ball bouncing off a wall. It would hit and go the other way and change directions at will. And then the ability to hover over the water and then start a vertical climb from basically zero up towards about 12,000 feet and then accelerate in less than 2 seconds and disappear is something I had never seen in my life.
Something he had never seen in his life. And joining me today from New York is journalist Leslie Kane. She's was one of the authors of that recent New York Times story that had the attention-grabbing headline, Glowing Auras and Black Money, the Pentagon's Mysterious UFO Program. She's also the author of the book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. Leslie, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Great to be with you.
And congratulations on helping to break this very important story. Now, that exchange between those Navy fighter pilots that we played here was released, correct me if I'm wrong, by this group that I think whose identity you revealed at the Pentagon, the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. Tell us what you learned about that program at the Pentagon, please.
Sure. Well, the program was initiated in 2007 in the Defense Intelligence Agency, and in 2009 it moved over to the DOD. And funding was provided through 2012, initiated by Senator Harry Reid and some colleagues that made the appropriations to the program. And actually, you said in your intro that it was defunct, but actually the funding stopped in 2012, but the program continued. Before 2012, the program was able to hire contractors, to hire a lot of scientists and experts to work with them from the outside. So they lost that in 2012. But the individuals, the officials who were working inside the DOD continued working, and the program actually is ongoing today.
It's ongoing today. How do you have a program without funding?
Well, what these are very high-level intelligence officials involved with a lot of different areas of work in their regular jobs. So what they've done is they've just incorporated these investigations into their jobs and just taken time to deal with cases that are brought to them. A lot of the cases are brought in from other agencies such as the Navy or the CIA. And these people just make the time within their regular jobs to deal with them, but not with the contractors like they had before.
And who are these people? Are these people who are assigned this responsibility? Are they ones who, on their own initiative, think that this is something that deserves to be studied? What do they have in common? And it sounds like they are seconded or something like that from their normal jobs. I mean, how much of their time do they spend working on these issues?
They spend a very small amount of time. Okay. I mean, that's definitely, you know, maybe you can ask a Mr. Elizondo. You know, he would know better than I, but
he's
I would say 5 to 10% of their 5% of their time, perhaps. I mean, it's very small. And these are people who obviously believe this is important. They're people that have had enough time investigating it to know that there is a real phenomenon there. And they believe that, you know, that it's under this name threat. It's really not – it's not like it's ever shown any hostility or aggression or any kind of danger in that level. But they do feel that it's a potential threat because these things seem to demonstrate incredibly advanced technology. I mean, that's how the officials describe them. And therefore, if they're flying around and interacting with military aircraft – this is something that needs to be taken seriously, and that's why they're involved. They think it's an important issue. It's a potential threat, and it's something that we should learn more about.
And you said what they all have in common is a belief that, quote, there is a real phenomenon there. Is that – do they all believe that, in fact, UFOs are real and it's a real phenomenon?
Yeah, I mean, it depends how you define UFOs. They do not, they're not saying by saying that they're UFOs, that these are alien spacecraft or extraterrestrial vehicles. I mean, that's the confusion that comes up. What these are just things that are flying around that we can't explain. They're unidentified objects. And yes, that's not even a matter of belief. There's absolutely no question that there are things up there flying around because they've been documented extensively. And the program would not exist if that weren't the case. So that's not the issue. The issue is, what are they? Where are they from? And that there's no way to answer. What they've been doing is just documenting what they have observed and trying to understand how these things might, behave and what the physics might be behind them. Because if this is indeed advanced technology, which it appears to be, that would be something that we might be interested in and learning more about. We might even be able to duplicate it.
Mm-hmm. How did you come to this, Leslie? You've been working on this for a long time. You wrote a book that was published in 2011. That's 6 years ago. What's your history here?
Thanks. It was actually 2010, but I started on working on this in 1999. It was a long time ago when I was working for a public radio station in California.
Hey.
And a colleague in France sent me this really incredible report that was put together by military officials in France, among them four generals and admiral, very high level study that they had done for 3 years about this phenomenon. And they documented all these military cases. And in this report, these officials concluded that they thought what they called the extraterrestrial hypothesis was the most valid explanation for what they had observed and studied. And just as a journalist, I was very compelled by that. I thought, these generals are saying this, admirals are saying this, scientists are saying this. I want to look into it. And that's how it all began. And so I spent many, many years doing it, and it all kind of culminated in my book in 2010.
Okay, Leslie, and now hold on, because I want to bring in Luis Elizondo. You mentioned him earlier. He's in Washington. He's a former director of the Pentagon's Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. He was an intelligence analyst at the Defense Intelligence Agency. Now he's the director of Global Security and Special Programs for To the Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences, which is a for-profit aerospace research company. Luis, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So we heard that dramatic Navy fighter video earlier in the program. Am I correct in understanding that you were largely responsible for getting that video released? It had been secret, correct?
Well, it was on a system, a classified system. But the video, as it was released, was stripped of any classification information that would be otherwise considered sensitive.
Right.
And that went through the official DOD classification review process and foreign disclosure process. So it was thoroughly vetted before that was authorized for release.
And Luis, tell us how you got involved in this research, you know, and how did you come to understand or see these unidentified objects?
Well, I guess we have to rewind the clock a little bit back to 2008 when I was asked by its then program director to come on board and provide some intelligence expertise. I was brought up to the program. And then in 2010, I was formally assigned as the director of the program, as the other program director had moved on. And that's how I came to be part of this very, very interesting and compelling effort that that several of my colleagues back in, of course, the Pentagon and other places were also involved with.
And may I ask if you came on in the beginning as a skeptic, as a believer, as, you know, a kind of a neutral party?
Well, certainly neutral, but I think a healthy degree of skepticism is always important. Please keep in mind that for you and your listeners, that the Pentagon and any apparatus of the national security within the United States, we tend to be paid to be a little bit skeptical and frankly paranoid too, because it's national security. And so basically we try to approach things from using the scientific method. We try to approach things very objectively and allow the data to speak for itself. One of the dangers I think we have in the world of intelligence, and we've seen what happens in the past when you do this, when you start overlaying opinions and bias and overlay that over the data and have that drive your data collection, chances are you may either miss something or you may come to a false conclusion. So it's very, very important that we remain very objective when we collect this data. Frankly, in a bit of a court of law, you know, innocent until proven guilty, we make the presumption that every single one of these things we're seeing is some sort of terrestrial aircraft or conventional aircraft until finally the evidence is so overwhelming that we have to conclude that maybe it's not.
Okay, well, I want to explore how you came to that conclusion after a break. We're discussing UFOs in the Pentagon. Are they from another star system? Could these UFOs simply be technology from another country? And here's some theme music from the popular TV show, The X-Files. I'm Tom Gelton. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton. We're discussing UFOs and the Pentagon's covert program to study them. You can join the conversation. Do you think there's life out there? How do you feel about the U.S. government secretly studying UFOs? And we're talking with Leslie Kane. She's the author of the book UFOs and also a contributing journalist to the New York Times story that revealed the Pentagon program for investigating UFOs. And from Washington, we have former intelligence officer Luis Elizondo. He is the director of the Pentagon's Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, a program that was funded up until 2012 but continues in some ways. And Luis, to stay with you, I want to go back to the premise that Leslie laid out earlier, which is that these things are real, but their exact nature and the source are unexplained. They could be of a terrestrial origin or an extraterrestrial origin. After these years studying this, Louise, where do you come down on that question? Do you actually think that some of these objects have an extraterrestrial origin?
So, Tom, if I may, you know, obviously I don't work for the Department of Defense anymore, so
correct.
I really can't give you the department's position on
it. I understand that.
But from a personal perspective, of course, and from a personal perspective, we place a tremendous amount of rigor and scientific methodology in trying to understand the performance characteristics of the things we were seeing and continue to see. And really, it comes down to a matter of logical deduction. If it's not ours and it's not from somewhere overseas, then it has to come from somewhere. Now, where that somewhere is still, I'm sure, up for quite a bit of hot debate right now. I'm certainly not a smart enough man to tell you or your listeners that I know where they're from. And I think from that perspective, that's why my organization, we were very, very focused on really just two interrogatives. The basically, what is it and how does it work? So the what and how. My position is that if we can figure out what it is and how it works, then everything else we'll be able to answer in time. Now, here's a little bit of good news for you and your listeners. I know a lot of money was spent on this, and it is a lot of money, but I will tell you, we've also come really, really far in our understanding. So I think for the very first time in those two questions of what is it and how does it work, I think we have a much better understanding now, potentially, of how it works. We still don't know what it is, but we're beginning to understand some of the advanced physics that help us describe what we're seeing.
Well, speaking of advanced physics, let's just play with this for a minute. The nearest star system is something like 6 trillion miles away. It would take...
Alpha Centauri, correct. And,
sorry?
Alpha Proxima.
Yes.
Alpha Proxima, correct. Yes, sir.
Yeah. So presumably, it would, barring time travel, which we probably shouldn't exclude, but barring time travel, it would take, what, hundreds of years, thousands of years for an object to make that, to cover that distance?
Yeah, sure. Well, let me ask you this. 150 years ago, when we were in horseback and we had to send mail across the United States, we would put it on a Pony Express, and it would take weeks and sometimes months to go from New York to San Francisco. And everybody thought that was amazing, until all of a sudden we have something called the telegraph. And now all of a sudden, in 6 hours to 12 hours, you could potentially get a message from New York to San Francisco through a very complicated relay of people doing Morse code, and get a rudimentary message across the continental United States. Now, of course, here we are, lo and behold, in the satellite age and the internet age, where everything is virtually instantaneous. So let me ask you this. If you were sitting back 150 years ago and someone were to tell you that we're going to have a capability to send a message and photographs and movies instantaneously virtually anywhere in the world, not just to San Francisco or New York, I think most people would agree that that would be impossible. And keeping in mind, now, of course, it's commonplace. And I think what we're really looking at here is a paradigm shift in the way we think about things. We have traditionally looked at physics in the sense of Einstein's relativity, quite frankly. So when you're looking at a star or any object out there, you say, sure, it takes X amount of time for light to travel from one place to another, and that's the, if you will, the universal speed limit. But we now realize that's not necessarily true. We know through quantum physics, and you know, perfect example is quantum entanglement, that space-time is malleable. Space-time is flexible. It's not a constant. In fact, it is in itself, depending where you are in space and time, it is different for you if you are either, for example, next to a very heavy supermassive object, or you're next to nothing and you're by yourself. So we know space and time can be stretched and compressed. The question is what type of technology would you need in order to do that in a way that's predictable and allows you to maneuver, if you will, in space time in a way that's relatively efficient and allows you, so to speak, get places presumably faster than you would be able to using normal physics. Quantum entanglement is a prime example, and this is certainly not world according to me. This is pretty much established fact. You can have two particles that are entangled, and if they are separated by simply a foot, a mile, 10,000 miles, or 10 billion miles, or 10 billion light years, believe it or not, the communication between those two entangled particles is instantaneous. So that means, in theory, you could have an entangled particle here and an entangled particle 13.5 billion light years away across the other side of the universe. And if this entangled particle here is stimulated in a certain way, that entangled particle that is literally across the other side of the universe will react, and that reaction is instantaneous. So we know there's some communication. There's something going on here that somehow is able to maneuver and operate where space-time really isn't doesn't really matter. So the question is, how do we figure that out? How do we do it? And we now know with science that supermassive heavy objects can warp space-time, but so can a whole lot of energy. So that's kind of where we're at now, trying to figure out what it takes. If one wanted to behave like some of these things are behaving, what technologies would it take for us to be able to do that, to warp or bend the space-time construct in a way that allows us to travel faster, so to speak?
All right. Well, Luis, I wish we could keep you all hour, the entire hour, because this is a really fascinating subject. I do understand that you have to go, so we're going to let you go. Luis Elizondo is a former official at the Defense Intelligence Agency and former director of the Pentagon's Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. Now he is director of global security and special programs for To the Stars Academy, which is a private company. Luis, thanks so much for sharing your expertise and experience with us here on OnPoint.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.
And let's go to our callers now. As you can imagine, our board is jam-packed with people who want to weigh in on this. First, we're going to go to Jean-Victor, who's calling from St. Bruno, Quebec. Jean, thanks for calling OnPoint.
Hi, Tom. My contribution would be to say that anything that moves as fast and is as noiseless as that could be an image.
An image.
And this yes, just an image, like an holographic image. But it serves no purpose other than that if you don't imagine something else, that is that this image is an artifact. An artifact of energy that's being transferred. It's you see it because maybe it serves a purpose of telling people not to go too near that energy because it could be dangerous. Maybe it's a willful design feature made in order for people to be aware that it's dangerous to go near, but as an energy transfer mechanism, it could very well be implemented using, I don't know what technology, but what you see is probably just energy transferring from one place to another.
Now, if it were just an image, are you assuming that that would mean it is terrestrial in origin, or could it be an image that is extraterrestrial in origin, and as you say, you know, for some reason warning us terrestrials to stay away?
I don't suppose it's a warning that's necessarily for us, but it's designed to transfer energy. I would assume it's from Earth to somewhere else, because it's very near Earth, so it could very easily come from Earth and go nearby to most likely to the moon. But to somewhere else that's near enough so that it doesn't dissipate in the...
Okay. Well, that's a fascinating theory. Jean-Victor, thanks for calling on point. Let's hear now from David, who is on the line from Clearwater, Florida. David, we're talking about UFOs. Your contribution this morning.
Tom, I have a very small... Good morning.
Good day.
I have a very small... bit to add, and it's basically that it was good to hear that Luis is now working outside of the Pentagon on this question because my comment was going to be, we presume that everything is evil and going to hurt us because we're the Pentagon and everything gets classified. So it takes 30 years to get it out to where people can look at it. If it's energy, maybe somebody's just trying to contact us and say, hey, but they're not, maybe they haven't advanced to the point where they can contact. They can get here, but they can't contact. And our minds have to be open to this. And as many people as can think about this and come up with ideas, we should allow them to think about it and come up with ideas. It shouldn't dictate policy, but militarizing it, it doesn't help.
Okay. Good point, David. I want to go back to Leslie Kane now. She is a journalist, and she was one of the co-authors of that New York Times piece that really advanced our thinking about UFOs. And Leslie, you know, in one of the stories about this piece that you wrote, not the piece itself, but one about it, I read that when Luis Elizondo met with you, he kept his back to the wall with his eye on the door. And I'm wondering, what is it like, either for a researcher like Luis Elizondo or a journalist like you, to be investigating these things? Is it, you know, do you find, you know, that people ridicule you? Do you find it hard to be taken seriously? Did you find that Luis found it hard to be taken seriously? What is sort of the, you know, the sort of the attitude that you come up against when you try to write seriously about these issues?
Well, when I first started this, Tom, back in – my first article was published in the Boston Globe in 2000. I was really, really worried about ridicule for the first – you know, while I was working on that piece. But I really haven't had a problem with it because I think it's because I've presented the material in such a way, as we did in the New York Times story, that we're not offering the kind of information that people can ridicule. I mean, a lot of what you read on the internet, there's plenty of stuff that people put up there that's probably worthy of ridicule, but I've just been so careful about the way I've managed this and what I've reported on that it really doesn't lend itself to that. And I think what you were talking about with Mr. Elizondo keeping his back to the wall, I mean, when he left the Pentagon and wrote this letter to Secretary Jim Mattis, and you know, he felt there was a big risk involved for him. He didn't know how they were going to respond. He had a very, very good relationship with the Pentagon. Got the highest praise for the work that he was doing, the highest possible evaluation.
It was a kind of a protest letter, right? Tell us a little bit. You mentioned this letter. Tell us about that letter.
Yeah. I mean, when he left, he wrote a letter to Secretary Mattis explaining that he was leaving because he was just so concerned that this initiative had not received the necessary funding, the necessary resources to do the job that needed to be done, that people inside the DOD, there was much opposition to it for various reasons. And he just felt that more attention needed to be devoted to this. It's an extremely important issue. And so he made that statement to the secretary when he left. And I think the first few weeks after he left, he was nervous. He didn't know how they were going to respond. He didn't know, you know, if he was – what would happen to him. And as I said, his relationship with his coworkers and the DOD was at the highest level. He had no criticism for them. So he was just dealing with a transition that was really nerve-wracking. And I think that's why he was – as he mentioned earlier, he said we tend to be a little paranoid, us intelligence – he's a counterintelligence official. So he would like to sit where he could see the door when we met.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, hang on for a minute, Leslie. I want to bring in Cheryl Costa now from Syracuse, New York. She writes the New York Skies UFO blog for the Syracuse New Times. She's a former military technician, a former information security professional in the aerospace industry, and she's the co-author with Linda Miller Costa of the book UFO Sightings Desk Reference, which tracks all the UFO sightings in America between 2001 and 2015. Cheryl, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. So, what's the trend here? I mean, you know, we've heard about UFOs for many, many years. Are we seeing more reports of UFO sightings, fewer reports? Is it pretty much the same trend as ever?
Well, okay. The easy answer is to say there's about 10,000 a year, okay?
Okay.
But like anything, there's trends upwards, there's trends downward, okay? So I'll give you an example. Our book was based on 2001 to 2015. And at that time, we published, there had been 121,000 reported sightings of UFOs in that 15-year period. Now, I've put 2016, 2017 numbers in there. Okay, I know 2017 isn't done, but the amount of difference we're going to pick up over the next 10 days is negligible. Okay, so our number for 17 years is 139,000 sightings reported. In the last 10 years, which has been kind of a peak 10 years, about 114,000 reported sightings. Now, when we say, does that mean every single one of them is something very exotic, like what Lewis was talking about? No. Good investigators say about 5% rather. And in our case, that's about 400 a year, possibly about 34 a month.
Okay, let me just clarify. So about 5%, 400 a year that are unexplained by other possibilities.
Yes.
Good enough. All right. Well, that's certainly something worth considering. And Cheryl, stick with us. We're going to come back to you after the break. I'm Tom Gelton. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton. We're talking this hour about UFOs, the Pentagon's program, and our own search for life beyond this Earth. You can join the conversation. Why do you think we're so interested in what's beyond, in stories of aliens coming to Earth? And, of course, over the years, there have been many movies made about aliens coming to Earth or about Earthlings traveling to outer space. There was the 1997 movie Contact, where Jodie Foster's character, astronaut Ellie Arroway, has just come back from another world far away in the universe. Nobody believes her, but then she tells them that what she did was true and what she saw was unimaginably beautiful.
I was given something wonderful, something that changed me forever, a vision of the universe that tells us undeniably how tiny and insignificant and how rare and precious we all are. A vision that tells us that we belong to something that is greater than ourselves, that we are not, that none of us are alone.
That none of us are alone. But we want to move this discussion away from the world of science fiction and into the empirical realm. And to help us do that, we have Leslie Kane. She is the author of the book UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. She was a contributing journalist to the New York Times piece that revealed the Pentagon's secret program for this. Also, Cheryl Costa, she writes the New York Skies UFO blog for the Syracuse New Times, and she's the co-author with Linda Miller Costa of UFO Sightings Desk Reference, United States of America, 2001 to 2015. She's a former military technician and information security professional in the aerospace industry. And one last question for you, Cheryl, before we go. Since you have studied sort of the history of these sightings, what is the history of U.S. government investigation of these sightings? How far back does it go, and what's kind of the trajectory or trend of U.S. government investigations of these sightings been over the years?
Well, probably the best we know is probably from World War II, when our bomber crews and fighter crews started seeing what they called Foo Fighters, these very unusual things. We all thought it was the Axis powers had something really special and fantastic. And, of course, when people came back from missions, they were debriefed. And after the war, we found out that the other side was seeing them, too, and they thought it was us. So this material has been around in at least in the military circles. The Wright-Patterson field, alien technology, they call it alien technology, actually foreign technology group, were the people who analyzed this stuff back after the war. Supposedly with Project Blue Book since about the 40s, late 40s, up until about 68 or 69, was studying this stuff. And then it went into, even though they publicly said they weren't studying it, it went into dark funding. And mm-hmm. From that point, we lost track of it.
My goodness. Okay, Cheryl Costa, blogger for the New York Skies UFO blog, co-author of the book UFO Sightings Desk Reference. Cheryl, thank you for joining us today and bringing us that sort of data perspective on this issue.
Happy to help.
And let's go now to a couple of callers who may have their own experiences or thoughts with unidentified flying objects. First of all, Henry, calling from West Palm Beach, Florida. Henry, thanks for calling On Point.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Good.
I had a what I consider a very fortunate and lucky experience back in February of about 1965. My sisters and my parents and I, Sunday evening, were eating dinner around 7 o'clock-ish, and we heard this oncoming roar approaching the neighborhood. And my father and I looked at each other. We knew it was a jet fighter flying at a low altitude. So we ran outside just to see this jet, and as we ran outside of the house, the jet had just cleared the overhang from our roof, and it turned on its afterburners. You could see the flames just coming out of the rear of the jet. It was a Air Force jet, and all of a sudden we noticed there was a bright, bright, bright star right in front of the jet that the jet was chasing, and it stayed equidistant in front of the jet for several seconds, and the jet was trying to catch up to this object. And all of a sudden, just out of nowhere, this object just took off and went up and to the right and literally within a couple of seconds disappeared into the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And the jet faded off to the left and made a left bank and just kind of gave up and I guess went back to the Air Force base. And so we ran inside. We were all excited about what we saw, and we called the TV stations and all this. And so later that night on the 11 o'clock news, we tuned into the news, and the news segment came on, no mention of it. The weather comes on, obviously, no mention of it. And the sports segment came on. And at the end of the sports segment, the sports anchor chuckled that he got a report that there were a group of hunters out in the Everglades, which was behind our house. A group of hunters were out hunting that same evening and reported that they had seen little green men out in the Everglades. So that's two things that happened in the same evening.
All right.
And there's nothing in my life that could ever change what I saw. And I just felt, to this day, I feel so lucky that I saw something that was so real and so beautiful.
I appreciate that, Henry. Thanks for sharing that experience with us. And joining us now from Bloomington, Indiana, is Susan Lepsalter. She's a professor of anthropology at Indiana University and the author of The Resonance of Unseen Things, Poetics, Power, Captivity, and UFOs in the American Uncanny. Susan Lepsalter, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
So you just heard, one of, I think, thousands probably of testimonies about apparent UFOs. Our lines are jammed. What is it that sort of explains this fascination that we all have with the notion of unidentified flying objects, do you think?
Yeah, well, exactly. I should make clear that I'm not trying to take a position on how real or true this data is in terms of whether it's extraterrestrial or not. So I'm looking at the cultural meanings of this, as you're pointing out. So I think that there is so much that's so fascinating for people about this. And, you know, these stories kind of come and go with greater and lesser urgency. As Cheryl pointed out, this is not the first federally funded study of UFOs. It's gone back 70 years. But right now we're feeling this incredible kind of resonance and urgency about the possibility of UFOs. And I just wanted to maybe point out some of the themes that tell us, you know, something about us and how, you know, earthly kinds of concerns and experiences play into our fascination with UFOs. So, for example, all of these stories are about a very advanced technology, and it's about a very ambivalent attitude towards technology. On the one hand, we have this capacity for wonderful, amazing, beneficial things. And on the other hand, you know, there's the capacity for great destruction. And all of these stories kind of revolve around this idea of technology. Even, you know, there's so many different kinds of UFOs stories too. So the ones we're talking about right now are ufological. They're very scientific. They're about trying to identify unknown things in the sky. But of course, we all know that there are other kinds of experiences that people relate, much more intimate kinds of experiences, abduction experiences, encounters and things like that, which have other kinds of concerns.
And, one of the notions here is that these people are, the word is aliens. Mm-hmm. And what is sort of the feeling about, let's say, our vulnerability as a planet to other worlds? Or, is it a fear or is it a hope? Mm-hmm. How do you categorize it?
I think what's so amazing is that it's both, right? So just think about when these stories start. They start right after the bomb. In 1947, there's a lot of nuclear anxiety, and we're having this kind of moment right now, of course, of climate change, nuclear anxiety, senses of surveillance, and our vulnerability, our sense of precariousness is very high right now, I would think. And when you think about an alien or a UFO, what it does is it reminds us that we are all citizens of Earth. And the Earth becomes our home. It becomes the place that we have to protect, the place that we're supposed to defend. And all of these stories, either the aliens are sort of, warlike and threatening, and, the government has to investigate them so that we can defend against an attack from the outside. Or there's also a lot of reports of, like in the Jodie Foster clip, that they provide some kind of insight or illumination. And in that case, they tell us, well, we better be careful about our own irresponsible use of things like nuclear power and the capacity for war. So, and also climate change and pollution and things like that, things that have to do with the Earth and our sense of vulnerability. I think you can't ignore that.
I want to go back to Leslie Kane now. She's the one of the co-authors of the New York Times piece that revealed the existence of a Pentagon program to explore unidentified objects. And Leslie, the reason I want to go to you is, as Susan Lepselter was just saying, there's sort of different ways to think about UFOs. One way is to think about them as a threat and to think that, we've got to be able to defend against them. We can also think about this as an opportunity for communication at a level we've never even imagined before. What's your sense of your sense of the way it makes most sense to think about this? You have focused, correct me if I'm wrong, you sort of have focused on perceiving these things as something that we need to feel worried about, right? We need to sort of prepare some defense for.
No, I mean, I have never focused on them that way, Tom.
Okay.
What my focus really is as a journalist is to focus on the data that we have. What do we actually know? And the issues about, aliens and what it might mean culturally, I think are fascinating, but they're really not not what I focus on as a journalist. I'm interested in the data, the observables, what the highest level people say who have worked with the phenomenon and have studied it, what the military pilots have reported, and things like that. So it sort of narrows it a little bit
But Leslie, why the Pentagon as opposed to the National Academy of Sciences, for example, investigating this? I mean, the Pentagon is in charge of thinking about threats.
That's true. And I think it's a really good question. And I think part of the reason that we don't have the National Science Foundation and others involved is this ridicule, this stigma that's associated mm-hmm. with this topic. I mean, it's very – scientists who are interested in it don't even talk about it because – and this is – I think this is one of the biggest things that may be occurring now with the release of this New York Times article and all the attention it's been getting is just to make the point that this should be taken seriously, it should be investigated. And what's kept people away from that is this stigma. And that's part of the reason why the Pentagon program was kept secret. And because Harry Reid has said this on the record, that if he had gone into Congress and talked about trying to fund something like this, it never would have passed muster because of this taboo we have in place. So that really needs to change. And I think if that can change, it'll open a lot of doors and we'll learn a lot more.
Susan Lepselter, mm-hmm. What's behind that stigma that that Leslie is talking about?
That stigma has, I think, become a little less as we're seeing right now.
Mm-hmm.
But UFOs were linked to the tabloids. They were linked to things that were ridiculed. I mean, there was a study by Harvard psychologists in the 90s with people who remembered UFO abductions. And, the conclusions were always, well, this was just sleep paralysis and And when the psychologists were interviewed about this, often the interviewers would say things like, well, aren't the people, you know, embarrassed? Don't they feel like this sounds crazy? I mean, there wasn't a lot of belief around it. But I do think that at this moment, culturally, we are at this moment where conspiratorial kinds of beliefs and all sorts of things that used to be kind of marginalized are front and center right now in all sorts of ways. And I think, you know, issues about surveillance, issues about climate change, you know, things about the role of the government and secrecy, all of these things are right now in the middle of our discussion. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense to me that talking about UFOs is part of that.
Well, part of the changes is that we certainly are our knowledge of theoretical physics is much advanced. Luis Elizondo was talking about quantum entanglements and at least being able to imagine the kind of travel that would be necessary in order for these things to have some kind of extraterrestrial origin. Quickly, one last call from Omar, who's on the line from Savannah, Georgia. Omar, thanks for calling On Point.
Thank you for taking my call. I'll make this as concise. There may be life elsewhere in the universe because they found planets in the so-called Goldilocks zone. But my point is that the distances are so vast in between star systems that you have to have, even light speed doesn't get it, you have to have faster than light travel, which and if the laws of physics are applied to both sides of the universe, so that's an impossibility. So that there's no possible way that life could reach us.
Okay. A quick comment from you, Leslie, and then we're going to have to wrap up.
Yeah, I mean, of course, that's a very big question. But as Mr. Elizondo said earlier, there are physicists who can explain using the concepts that Einstein has evolved that have to do with the bending of space-time. I mean, I've sat down and heard some of them explain how it is conceivable that very advanced civilizations could manipulate space-time in such a way that they could move from one spot to another very, very quickly. So that puts to bed the speed limit of the speed of light. And that's just something that needs to be, again, talked about more. And you've got to go to a physicist for that. But it can be explained in that level, though.
Well, or an anthropologist who can talk about how advances in science have to sort of broaden our imagination. Right, Susan?
Absolutely. And also going backwards, thinking about the things that sort of haunt us. I mean, think about this story. It's about beings coming from another world and using advanced technology to conquer and colonize us. That sounds familiar to the beginnings of America, does it not?
It sure does. Susan Lepsalter is professor of anthropology at Indiana University and author of The Resonance of Unseen Things. Susan, thanks much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
And Leslie Kane, journalist and author of the book UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. Leslie, you've made a great contribution. Thanks to you.
Thanks very much, Tom.
You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, which is onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Gelton. This is On Point.